Okay, we have learned a lot. I have really enjoyed the two previous lectures. And likely think a little more about that as we move forward. I know that that's true. Those principles have been applied on my own farm and farms around, and they sure do work. One thing, as you look at this slide, you notice kind of a section, and what makes the soil really come alive is those plant roots. As they provide the exudates that really supply the sugars, proteins, or the microorganisms in there that make eventually will make nutrient availability and build soil structure, soil stable, water stable aggregates. But I think the reverse is true. You see a hand picking it up and holding it. It's interesting to think about the other part of that, that the soil actually made the hands. The hands made the soil. And I think if we think about that a little bit different, it might be an interesting approach to what we do. So, I thought we need a little levity in here. But, it is really true. If you don't plant something on the ground, it will wash away. And we saw great examples of that here. So what do we plant? What do we plant to keep the soil from washing away? And in conjunction with that, we have the three big properties of soil, the physical properties, which we address in, with the deep soil penetration. And I might say that when you build those soils and you do that deep soil preparation, you really, the goal is not to do that for the rest of your life. The goal is to create stable soil that will last, that you don't have to do that. Once you get it right, then a simple surface cultivation, if necessary, allows you to maximize production. And that's really, to me, the end game of it all. Biological activity, chemical properties. So, as we work together with these anthropogenic and natural synergies to soil improvements, meaning that I apply some of my energy to loosen up the soil that allows the biology of the soil, the roots to penetrate, and allows it to do its work, we work kind of together. At some point, I need to step back and move away from tillage, move away from any kind of soil disruption, and let nature take over. And I think that, you know, a wise farmer knows when to back off and let the natural system just take over. And I wanted to mention a couple things of how this biointensive system really helps to accelerate soil growth. It avoids soil compaction by permanent pathways and beds, which is difficult to do if you walk on anything. And the deep soil development creates a womb, where you're talking about the things we talked about before, air, water, organic matter, and minerals. And if you think about the earth as a womb that you are creating for future plants, I think it helps. Talk about the rise of sphere development, the deep development of the soil, so that you can have deep root penetration. A lot of sequestration of carbon. A lot of the new literature coming out of peer review and carbon movements in soil finds that some of the most stable and long-term carbon is happening at 50 to 60 centimeters. And so this deep soil preparation allows for that to develop at a faster rate. And then water storage, as we talked about before. Also with those closing canopies of intensive production, and we reduce water and wind. We sometimes forget wind, depending on a global basis. About two-thirds of our soil is lost by water movement, and a third is lost by wind movement. So wind also has the effect of reducing yield and permaculture design to constrict or allow wind movement enhances a lot of that photosynthesis and productive capacity. So creating a microclimate with dense plant spacings protects the soil organisms, control heat movement in the soils because they have it completely covered over, and the CO2 outgassing increases the plant utilization. This is a very old slide from Essex and England, and it really points out how we can live at our soils and how it has an effect on root structure. We've known these things for a long time and still seem to really need to relearn them every century or so. So one thing I wanted to talk about was ways that we can increase efficiency, because I talk about compost crops and making compost and reapplying it. How could we maximize, if organic matter is the holy grail of soil development, how could we maximize that? And there are several ways that are inherent in the system to do that. One is by increasing yields, and you'll see that in the data from Ascalientes. Cold composting as opposed to warm composting, where you don't liberate a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. You can capture it over periods of time and much more stable humic and carbonic and other kinds of acids. And that includes making good carbon to nitrogen ratios. We found that 45 to 1 carbon to nitrogen really bumps up the yield. All these are things that farmers can do to really get more and better carbon back to their farm to increase the yield. And then work more on structural, less on metabolic carbon. I'll talk about that in relationship to the sunflowers that part of my diet design, Jerusalem artichokes, and other crops. So let's just slip through here a little bit, and you're welcome to check those out. So I wanted to, like Warren said, if the PowerPoints are available, you can check them anytime. So the work done by Dr. Emmanuel Amunde at the University of Wyoming, who is the director of Manor House Agricultural Station in Kitale, Kenya for 20-some years, he worked at this offset. So the question is, when you pack them in an offset spacing, do you get an increased yield over conventional agriculture? And it addresses some of the questions we've had at our table. So the offset close spacing increased the May grain yields by 1.3 times over the non-conventional. What's equally as important is that in this study, he compared number 9, which is a Kenyan basic open-pollinated corn, with a hybrid corn, and he grew it either in close plant spacings or traditional row spacing. Another variable was in the biointensive system and in conventional production. And what he found was that a couple interesting things is that the hybrid and the open pollinated really grew twice as much yield as they did in conventional production. So I thought that was significant as well. And then you say, well, if you initially have to put in, and for some time until the soil gets to the maximum soil structure it can, the question is, how much energy are you putting into it? And that's a question that I needed to address with all that energy work I talked about earlier and slipped through. He addressed it in terms of benefit and cost ratio and felt fairly confident that the extra work you put into it, there's a number of others, factors. He has a number of charts and tables that indicate the amount of labor that went into it. That is published in the Journal of African Agriculture, and the citation is in the bottom of the PowerPoint. So here's the work in Ascalientes, very arid condition. This is what they started with. About 8 years later, this is what they ended up with. And the question is, how much did the soils change over time? So if you look at organic matter, it started at, which wasn't too bad actually, at 1.4 for that area. Over time, after 7 years, it went to 3.8% organic matter. Remember, every time you double that or get into this kind of a bracket, you're adding plus and minus one pH point to nutrient availability. So that's really critical when you look at buffering systems, when you can have the minerals in the soil, but you can't access them. And you change that with either gypsum or lime, depending on other factors, or you increase the organic matter so that the chemical reactions can happen over a broader span of pH. The other things that he added over time. So, as I mentioned, if you take a piece of soil and you have grow a crop and you compost it and it's short of boron, it's going to be short of boron when you add your compost back. Now, that's if it's if it's there's none to be available. If you increase the organic matter in the soil, you may find that there's boron available. But say there isn't any. In this case, that was true. He added some gypsum, elemental sulfur, phosphoric rock, and a little alfalfa meal. And what was interesting over time is that over time, look at the biomass as it increases. First, edible yields increased about 40%. And then over that time, so you're getting more food value for the same unit of ground. And then here, then your biomass slightly more than doubles. So what you get into is a positive, there's a slide missing in the end there, but what happens over time is a positive feedback where the more you grow your carbon crops, your compost crops, and they do multiple functions, right? Don't think of them as, oh, I have to grow that and I don't get any value. If I'm eating corn, I have a compost crop. If I'm eating wheat, I have a compost crop. If I'm eating Jerusalem artichoke sunflowers, I have a compost crop. If I use fava beans, I have a compost crop. And when you look at the diagrams that we worked on in the earlier, you can identify if I have 40 beds I'm growing all my food, and I've got 12 months that I'm growing, how many bed crop months do I have? 40 times 12. 480 bed crop months. Those are the months I can grow it. Now, if I have only water in a certain season, I can define that as so many bed crop months per that season. What does that mean? In my particular diet, I was only using 322 bed crop months. The rest of the time, the garden was underutilized. As I look at that, I can now say, I can fill in. I've got 6 weeks here. I've got a couple months here. I can start to fill in those bed crop months, and you know I can either provide more food, more carbon, and all the time as I'm adding plants, I can fill soil. So it's a positive feedback. The more you grow, the more compost you make. The more crops you grow, the more compost you make. And it really can make a difference. It made a difference in Kitale, made a difference in Kenya, made a difference in South Africa. So thank you very much.
Thank you.